Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Senate Republicans' rejection of an effort to restore unemployment benefits to 1.3 million Americans who were cut off on December the 28th. Joining us is Thomas Herschel, who recently co-authored a report at the Associated Press on the widening gap of wealth inequality in the United States, where 4 out of 5 adults have struggled with joblessness and near poverty. 50 years after the war on poverty was declared, we will discuss the war on the poor by Republicans who have cut food stamps and unemployment benefits in an apparent effort to increase poverty in America rather than end it. Then we'll look into the efforts underway on Capitol Hill to sabotage the P5+1 diplomatic deal with Iran, with a new sanctions bill being pushed in the Senate by Republican Mark Kirk and Democrat Robert Menendez. MJ Rosenberg, a special correspondent for The Washington Spectator, who worked on Capitol Hill for a number of Democratic senators and House members for 15 years and also worked for AIPAC, the lobby behind the efforts to scuttle the deal, joins us to discuss what is driving Israel's defense minister to insult America's Secretary of State and why AIPAC is working overtime to kill Obama's diplomatic opening with Iran. Then finally, we'll speak with Bob Kincaid, the co-founder of the Appalachian Health Emergency Campaign and chair of the board of the Coal River Mountain Watch, about the broader environmental and health issues affecting the people of West Virginia beyond the current crisis over a chemical spill that has the nation's attention at the moment. Apparently, the 300,000 residents of the Kinawaha Valley are merely the latest West Virginia residents to be exposed to deadly toxins, which are routinely used across the state in mining and mountaintop coal removal. Joining us now is Thomas Herschel, the director of the Population and Development Program and a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. He recently co-authored a report at the Associated Press on the widening gap of wealth inequality in the United States, where 4 out of 5 adults have struggled with joblessness and near poverty. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Herschel.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And your report, by the way, has the full report come out yet?
Because I remember. No, it's a book that's in press right now. It'll be coming out April 1st with Oxford University Press.
Well, at the time that the Associated Press story came out, it shocked a lot of people that 4 out of 5 adults at some point had experienced near poverty and joblessness. Now, with what's happening lately with the Republicans cutting food stamps and now the Senate on Tuesday rejecting an effort to restore the cuts that came in on December the 28th put 1.3 million Americans out of luck as far as any income is concerned. What do you attribute this trend to, if you will?
Yeah, I think it's kind of the politics of the country, the way it's working right now, that we're sort of living in this American dream and in the true sense of a dreamlike state, and we're not really talking to each other about the experiences that we're having and our common needs to really not just rebuild the safety net, but rework how the economy distributes goods and services. I think if you look at the labor market in the country, around the year 2000, the percent of the population that's actually working as a ratio of the population started going down, even before the recession, and then it really dipped down when the 2007 recession hit. And I think that's reflecting technological changes and really fundamental things happening in our society, and so people are hurting. And this is something that's been going on for decades, since the 1970s. It's just becoming much more acute right now, where you have this situation of long-term unemployment. And I think it's really good that we have this radio show to talk about this, but we need to have new kinds of political leadership. I mean, I think it's correct that the Republicans are taking kind of the far-right position, but I think austerity is sort of wired into the DNA of Washington right now, that the money behind politics doesn't want to be spending it on programs that benefit the general public.
Instead of programs that benefit them directly. I mean, the guy that's pushing the deficit, the sky is falling over the deficits, is Pete Peterson, a Wall Street billionaire. And I, for the life of me, do not understand why he's on a jihad against Social Security, which has been the best anti-poverty program in the history of the United States.
That's correct.
What do these people want? Do they want more and more homeless, starving, and distressed people in the streets of America. What is their agenda?
Well, I think their agenda is that they have serious problems of spending $85 billion a month in so-called quantity, which is basically keeping the bond market alive so that interest rates are low so the economy can keep going. They're trying to stave off economic problems for themselves, and there's no effective political opposition from the average person in the country saying this is what we need. We need a jobs program, health care, all the things that people need, housing. Housing's become very unaffordable now for more and more people. There's all kinds of issues that people have that just aren't being voiced in the political system. And so this is really, it's really a social crisis for the society. I mean, the NIH recently found out, it's a very interesting statistic, that in 1,000 counties in the U.S. over the last 10 years, the death rate has gone up for women because so many men are in jail or they're fighting wars and they're not at home. And so the social stress, or that's what people think it is, that it's very unprecedented for the death rate to go up among women, who generally have better health than men. And I think it's kind of things are kind of at a breaking point, I think, for the country in terms of the way the common person is living.
So, again, Thomas Herschels is the director of the Population and Development Program and a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. He recently co-authored a report at the Associated Press on the widening gap of wealth inequality in the United States, where 4 out of 5 adults have struggled with joblessness and near poverty. And that, as he mentioned, will be coming out soon in a book. When you said we have to rethink the American dream, is the American dream a delusion then? The idea that we have upward mobility, that you can make it. If we have this statistic, which was not addressed by the Senate in 2 separate votes, that they didn't get the 60 votes necessary to overcome a filibuster to go forward on extending the unemployment benefits that were cut on December 28th that have put 1.3 million Americans out of luck with no income. And the point being that the long-term unemployment we have in the United States is still as high as it's ever been since World War II. There are 4 million people who have been out of work for 27 weeks or longer, and we know that others have dropped off the map as well, who simply aren't counted anymore.
Yes, I think the thing that people really there's a lot of things about the American dream. It has a lot of different components to it. It's kind of a mixed bag of ideologies. But I think the thing that people care about most is they want to be able to work hard and then in exchange for that derive some level of economic security. So, you know, a future for their children, a retirement, to be treated at work with respect, some very basic things that people want. The American people don't, it's very clear in the public opinion literature, they don't want to be rich. They just want to feel secure. And that's exactly what they're not getting right now. So that's a kind of explosive situation where the thing that people want most, the system isn't delivering to them. Even if they have a job, they feel, I mean, I've seen interviews where people say, well, I am the American dream, but I worry about my children, because they see that something's coming at them that's taking away their basic security.
So what, though, explains the callousness of people like the Republican lawmaker, the one particularly down there in Tennessee, Stephen Fincher, whose family farm has been receiving millions subsidies, and yet he gets up on the House floor and says that quotes the Bible saying if you don't work you shouldn't eat.
Okay.
And we know that the recipients of food stamps are usually single mothers who are holding down usually low-paying jobs and working hard and trying to navigate between whether or not to have enough money to pay for to get to work or to put food on the table. So I don't understand that attitude, and I don't understand the attitude of the Senate Republicans who are now accusing the Democrats of playing games. But at the end of the day, this is only $6.4 billion we're talking about here, which is nothing compared to the federal budget.
That's right. That's right. I think people are seeing things from their point of view, and there's no center of gravity for people to relate to have discussions about what are the real solutions to the issues that people are facing in our society right now? The fact that technology is very rapidly doing away with the kind of jobs that the unskilled and semi-skilled, even some of the skilled jobs that people have, are being done by computers now. And I think that we need to really rethink what it means to work and what it means to contribute to society. But we're not doing that because the society is the people that have the most the interests that are strongest, are most decisive on politics are the interests of money. I mean, campaigns. The last presidential campaign was over $1 billion in total expenses, and that's so the economics of the rich getting richer and the rest of us not going anywhere. That's being reflected politically. So those the kind of statements you're talking about, Ian, which I think are outlandish, really reflect there's an economic base for that, and that there needs to be some new kind of politics in the country. And the Democrats aren't really set up to oppose what the Republicans are doing, and a lot of that comes out of the South. I mean, there was, you know, a very important thinker in American history, W.E.B. Du Bois, talked about how, you know, Wall Street controls the South and the South controls the country. That is, the influences of the South and the conservatives, they come from the same corporations, just that the corporations have more power down there because of racial disenfranchisement. And that's been really, the brake on that has really been taken off by the Supreme Court with the amendment to not enforce, or the decision not to enforce the Voting Rights Act. So I think we have an extreme situation developing in the country that needs to be addressed with some new kind of politics.
Well, you appear to be talking, Thomas Herschel, about a new kind of feudalism here. Is that what you're saying?
That's a good term.
Right. Because I know that the billionaire investor Warren Buffett has warned that we are rapidly becoming a plantation economy, which, of course, has echoes of the South. So just explain that further, though.
I think that you have, like in the state of Georgia, the Republican Party has a supermajority in the state legislature, and they're able to, using GIS software, manipulate voting districts so that they're able to gain power at the expense of the poor and the minorities in the South, and to use race as a way to divide the popular vote and to gain power. And so money has more sway over the South than it does over the rest of the country. And it is kind of like, it does reflect the history of the country and the distance between social classes, which is, you know, there's always been a more poverty in the South, for example, even though there's more opposition to programs that would help the poor in the South. So those kind of contradictions are really a very central part of American history. At the same time, you do have social movements in the South, Moral Monday and in North Carolina, for example. So people are standing up and saying, we're against this, they're taking action. But there's not a real discussion going on in the country about the importance of that and how to sort of build on it.
Right, and the southern states are, of course, so-called right-to-work states, where unions are basically have little traction, and where foreign companies are being invited in to build, Mercedes, Volkswagen, BMW.
That's right.
And the Japanese cars, et cetera, at the expense of the northern unionized factories up in Detroit that produce American cars. So
that's right. I mean, the automobile industry is not centered in Michigan anymore. Is between Atlanta and Mexico City, where it's in the South or it's in Mexico a lot. Mexico is one of the biggest exporters of automobiles now, where labor is cheaper and labor unions are much more politically handled more effectively by corporations. So I think you have just a really, the world is changing very rapidly, and it's hard to keep up with it.
Well, but as a political issue, which it would seem, given what just happened with the Republicans' vote in the Senate, the two votes, and, of course, the Republicans accusing the Democrats of grandstanding and making an issue out of it, and perhaps the Democrats are putting them on the record, as Harry Reid says, this is how you're voting,
Right.
He says, the question is, are Republicans filibustering unemployment benefits? Are they not? And they clearly are. So,
they are.
So this is what seems to be going on as a political maneuver, that the Democrats are trying to get the public's and the press's attention that the Republicans are at war with the poor, which certainly appears to be the case. Now, in Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, apparently on a right-wing talk show in Kentucky, where he's running for re-election, and he's considered to be vulnerable, he made a joke about extending unemployment benefits. He laughed about it, and that's given his Democratic opponent, Alison Grimes, an opening where she's going to town on him. So my question is to you, Thomas Herschel, is there enough compassion in this country left for people, the majority of the American people, to take the side of the Democrats on this, that indeed we should be taking care of our fellow Americans who are having a temporary problem here and for no fault of their own need some help, and that they and this idea that they don't want to work and they don't want jobs is really quite a cruel hoax, given the evidence.
Definitely
that's out there.
People want to work, and I think people do understand that. I think that the idea of individualism, the kind of ideological platforms that people are using to defend their behavior, those are also part of the way that people think about their society, and I think that there needs to be more discussion about this. There's not a lot of it's hard to educate, given the dialogue that's going on. It's hard to make progress, because if the dialogue starts from the far right, it's hard to go anywhere unless you have something coming from, a very strong opposition. And my feeling is that in some ways the Democrats, they're not able to really provide the opposition that's needed to the kind of austerity that's emerging out of Washington. And I don't know what to say about that, except that I think there needs to be a new kind of politics. That's what I keep talking about.
Well, just in the last minute or so, what would the new kind of politics be?
I think it has to be something about social class, that there we need to have someone who's looking at things from the point of view of people that work, and that there's a separate program, not just about the safety net, but about the way that the economy is organized and managed. If there could be some, for example, nationalizing the energy industry as a way to begin to deal with the environmental issues and not leave it in private hands anymore. I think that we need to start thinking about that, because we have these examples of private enterprise just not being able to effectively change, so that we're taking care of the environment. Questions like that are more radical solutions to the problems we face.
Well, Thomas Herschel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me in.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Herschel, who's the director of the Population and Development Program and a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. He recently co-authored a report at the Associated Press on the widening gap of wealth inequality in the United States, where 4 out of 5 adults have struggled with joblessness and near poverty. And that study will be coming out as a book very soon. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about efforts on Capitol Hill to kill President Obama's diplomatic opening with Iran.
Don't lag behind. Bring me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working man blues. Well, I'm sailing on back, ready for the long haul. Tossed by the winds and the seas, I'll drag them.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is MJ Rosenberg, who's a special correspondent at the Washington Spectator and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years and previously served as the director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, MJ Rosenberg.
Oh, thank you, Ian.
And what's going on here on Capitol Hill, where you've got on Tuesday, a group of four dozen House Democrats met privately in the White House. The White House is concerned about the Senate bill by Republican Mark Kirk and Democrat Robert Menendez getting traction in the House. Eric Cantor is picking it up in the House. He's also talking with Steny Hoyer, who's apparently very much in AIPAC's corner. So could AIPAC and the House and Senate scuttle the president's and opening? And by the way, it's not just the president's, the P5 plus one that just closed this deal with Iran on Sunday.
Well, the bill, which, as you said, it's the Menendez Kirk Schumer bill in the Senate. And that's where most of the action will be. Already has 58 co-sponsors, so it's getting really close to assuming that the president says he would veto the bill if it passed. Because he knows, and the Iranians say that if we add more sanctions after agreeing to a deal that includes in part lifting sanctions, they will walk away. So the president is saying, this is a major foreign, policy initiative by the United States and by our allies and the Russians and the Chinese. And a big international effort, and we would be, betraying the terms of the deal by imposing sanctions. But AIPAC, which is pushing this bill, is very close to the 67 to overturn a presidential veto, which would be almost unprecedented.
And what's happening in the House?
Well, it wouldn't be a problem at all to get to get two-thirds for an override because the House is Republican. Mm-hmm. You start out with the fact that the majority of the House is Republican. Plus, you have all these Democrats who are, the number two Democrat, Steny Hoyer, is vehemently on board with this thing. So I think the House would be a lost cause. The action will be the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Why did the president have this group of four dozen House Democrats over at the White House, led by Florida Democrat Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's normally been a very, very strident supporter of AIPAC, and they apparently are very concerned that this thing's going to screw up the diplomatic opening with Iran?
Yeah, they are very concerned, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz is also concerned, and she is strongly behind the president's effort. It just shows you how serious a threat this is to a president's ability to conduct foreign policy. If you have Debbie Wasserman Schultz joining the White House in trying to defeat this AIPAC initiative, but she was there to stand next to the administration people and join in saying this would be terrible for the United States, and of course she would say also for Israel because very likely if there is no deal, if it just all falls through, there'd be a war. And, that would be a war that obviously not Israel would be involved in because Israel would probably initiate it. So she has the credibility with the pro-Israel camp to say, hey, this would be bad for Israel too. But I have no doubt that the Israeli government is behind this effort. I mean, AIPAC doesn't act without getting its orders from the Israeli government. So this is kind of a really unprecedented. I have to say, Ian, I find it hard to believe that AIPAC would even allow itself to win this one. In other words, you're taking on the President of the United States, undermining him and the United States in general in front of the entire world, and demonstrating to the whole world that our foreign policy is dictated by a lobby for a foreign government. Does AIPAC really want that to become so obvious that there's no argument against it? Well, that would be the case if they succeeded in overriding the president's veto. The fact of the matter is, the only people, there's only two real, sectors that are opposed to the Iran deal. It's, you got the Saudis who are against it because of the, their enmity within the region, but the Saudis don't have a lobby essentially in the United States, beside which it's just a foreign lobby. They don't operate the way AIPAC does. They can't give money to campaigns. So on the other side, you have AIPAC and all these neocons, these neocon intellectual types, all of whom are associated with the Israel lobby, are the ones who are pushing this whole thing. If AIPAC wasn't pushing this, this wouldn't be happening. So that's why I say it would be just an incredible thing to see a president of the United States and United States foreign policy defeated by this lobby.
Well, already we've had Bernadette Meehan of the National Security Council spokeswoman suggesting that those that are opposing this in Congress, they should basically step up and say that they're for war, which is what they are for war. Is that an argument? Because you just mentioned it too, that that's basically what it comes down to.
That is what it is. So amazing, though, last night, after she said that, Steny Hoyer, the Democratic majority leader of the House, denounced her and the White House for saying it. Didn't say, he came out with a statement saying, it's not true, we're not for war. Well, if you read the bill, it is for war. Because it says, it right in the bill itself, that if Israel feels the need to go to war over this Iran nuclear issue, the United States must automatically go to its aid, including, it specifically spells out, with military force. Automatically. We didn't even automatically go to war when Pearl Harbor was bombed. But that is what this thing says, without even a declaration of war. So we basically this AIPAC or Menendez Kirk resolution is giving America's power whether to make war or make peace to a foreign government, and spells it out in legislative language.
Again, I'm speaking with MJ Rosenberg, who's a special correspondent with the Washington Spectator and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years and previously served as the director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's APACS biweekly publication on Middle East policy. So If this is being driven by Israel, and as you point out, it's highly unlikely that AIPAC would be operating on its own since it is the American-Israel Political Action Committee, that this must be coming from Netanyahu. What is going on there with Netanyahu's defense minister insulting the Secretary of State, the defense minister, Moshe Yalon, said in an interview with a major Israeli paper, he said that John Kerry, who has come to us determined and is acting out of an incomprehensible obsession and messianic fervor, cannot teach me anything about the conflict with the Palestinians. Now, he's subsequently, this has upset the U.S., and he subsequently apologized. But I think his attitude is pretty clear. And that's an attitude, by the way, that's been expressed before by Netanyahu and others in the Likud. So what's going on there?
Oh, it just struck me as you were reading that. Imagine if America's Secretary of Defense said that those same kind of things about Israel's Minister of Foreign Affairs. That person would be sacked immediately. A member of the American government is not allowed to speak in an unfriendly, unloving manner about anyone in Israel's government. And here you have the top Israeli of the defense establishment saying these awful things about our Secretary of State when Israel is a recipient of more foreign aid from the United States than any other country. Fact of the matter is, this government, and I'm not going to say this is not all the Israeli people, this government, this Likud right-wing orthodox settler coalition hates Barack Obama. No matter that Barack Obama has been excessively pro-Israel during his term, they hate him. They've hated him since the first minute that they laid eyes on him. In fact, during the 2008 campaign, I have a big New York Times story saying there were two countries in the world that were not for Barack Obama, and one was the Republic of Georgia, which liked John McCain, and the other one was Israel. Israel is a country where the Israeli government despises Barack Obama, and that's in total, totally in contrast to American Jews, for instance, who voted for Obama 78% to 20%. It's just they don't like him. They want him out. And sometimes what happens is with Netanyahu and these other guys, it just bubbles out of them. You can I noticed today that the president of Israel, Shimon Peres, who's from the other side of the political aisle, an old Labor guy, is came right out and said Barack Obama is one of the best friends Israel ever had. But he's 90 years old, and his group is totally out of power. This is the Netanyahu crew, and they can't stand Obama.
And what about what?
They don't like any Democrats, though. I think the one they do like is Hillary Clinton, but that's another story.
Well, what about John Kerry? He's been a faithful APAC supporter in his entire career.
Yeah, you think so? Yeah, but
and Joe Biden, by the way, Joe Biden is very, very. Totally pro-APAC and pro-Israel. He's voted every time the way that they've wanted. So what's their problem with those two guys?
Well, I think that I think there's a distinction between the two. Joe Biden's language about Israel is totally over the top. I mean, it's crazy stuff where he says there must be no daylight. This is the exact quote, no daylight. No daylight, he repeats it, between Israeli and American policies, which would be bizarre if you said it about Canada. John Kerry does not talk that way. I think that, I worked on Capitol Hill I worked in the lobby, and I know I've sat in rooms with both these guys, Biden and Kerry. Neither one of them can stand Netanyahu and that gang. They are both peace guys privately. I don't think that we have anyone on in the Democratic side of the aisle, except maybe a few who actually believe this stuff. But the difference also now would be that Kerry's not running for anything anymore, so he can say to heck with the lobby, I'm going to push for a peace deal, and you don't hear boo from Joe Biden about anything where he'd be in any kind of opposition to the lobby. The hypocrisy of it all is awful. And the worst hypocrisy is among the Democrats and people like Al Franken and, Barbara Boxer and people like that. Even Elizabeth Warren, who is not supporting the APAC sanctions bill, hasn't put out a word praising this remarkable deal that Obama pulled off with Iran. The best Democrats are silent on this. With the exception of a few. And I do give credit here to Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I saw today Barbara Mikulski spoke out. Senator Feinstein spoke out. A few. But they're always looking at their shoulder. They're watching those APAC checkbooks.
And if 78% of American Jews are liberal and voted for Obama, in contrast to the current Israeli government who apparently hate him, where are these checks coming from? Are they coming from the 20% of the Sheldon Adelsons?
Well, well, they don't come from the Sheldon Adelson. Sheldon Adelson only gives to Republicans, so, and that's almost. But when you're talking about, you're talking about a few hundred people giving lots of monies through all different ways. We're not talking about the AIPAC money. Is a few, literally a few hundred people associated with AIPAC, but many of them are billionaires. So, and there are all kinds of ways you get around the, you know, electoral, you know, the various limits, you know, soft money, all these different kinds of devices. But we're not talking about the Jewish community at large. This is, you know, in this regard, it's important to say that the politics of Israel are like the politics of everything else in this country. It's all about a few fat cats. We're not talk when we talk donors. We're talking, the Koch brothers and people who were they're not involved with this issue, but the Koch brothers and the Adelsons and that Hillary Clinton's her top donor is this the billionaire. He's an Israeli American who invented Power Rangers. I forgot his name. He lives in California. He's our top donor.
Right.
I mean, it's just like we're not talking about people, you know, down the street who are writing a check for $100. We're talking about the big money. And then, you know, when you look at someone like Chuck Schumer, pretty much, you know, he tends to, you know, he supports all the special interests to give him money, whether it's, you know, he's a big friend of the banks. He's a big friend of Wall Street. You know, he made sure that derivatives weren't regulated in before 2008, and he's a big friend of AIPAC. People like that, Democrats like Schumer and Menendez and Gillibrand and, so many of them, both Minnesota senators, they just go where the money is. I mean, it's really, and there isn't any money on the other side. I mean, that makes it different than some other issues. I mean, there are issues where the fat cat side is opposed by some other side that has some clout. They're really there's the pro-Likud side and the which has tons of money, and there's no one on the other side that gives money on that same issue, but on the other side saying peace supporters.
Well, what about JPAC? Is anybody are they taking a stand on this?
J Street has no money.
Right.
If J Street had access to AIPAC's money, then these people would be saying the opposite.
Right.
It's just that's the way it is, and I just sometimes I get very I'm very conscious of always focusing on AIPAC. That's my issue, but that's the, we're in a country where that the billionaires rule, and if you haven't seen it yet, you definitely want to see Robert Reich movie Inequality for All,
right,
about the way how the super wealthy run this country. That's the way it is on every issue. But what grates me about this one is this is a foreign policy issue. This is a lobby that's acting in the interest of a foreign government. In other words, I can't stand the NRA and what they represent, but at the same time, they are an American interest group. This is a faux American interest group. In other words, it's made up of Americans, the AIPAC. You can't be a non-American and be part of AIPAC. But it's taking its directions from a foreign government. And, every other country, no other country has an AIPAC type thing. Other foreign countries are represented by foreign agents. Foreign agents aren't allowed to be involved in politics. That was the brilliance of inventing AIPAC, to be an American organization that's doing the bidding of a foreign government and getting away with it.
So what is then the logic or the strategy here from Netanyahu and these others, their supporters in AIPAC? If they want war with Iran, why, and they're against this diplomatic opening, I don't understand the logic of it. Because if you use the analogy with the Soviet Union, where we had military confrontation, we had a Cold War because we couldn't afford to have a hot war, otherwise we'd all be dead. But the same logic applies, that rock and roll brought down the Iron Curtain as much as anything else. And the same is true in Iran. You know, you've got a moderate opening here. Most of the young and the women are tied with this hideous theocratic radical government. And as you mentioned, you got this proxy war going on with Saudi Arabia, where you have a choice between two incredibly fanatical, Islamic terrorist governments, you know, going at each other. But the people are not the same, and the Iranian people want to join the world, and that's why they voted overwhelming for this new guy. So you've got to do things gradually and finally get rid of this government. You can't take them head on. The last thing you can do is have a war with them, because all that will do is rally the Iranian people around the flag.
Well, you know that I agree with you. That is so right. I mean, and it would seem that, you know, for any thinking person could figure it out that way, including Israelis, who tend to be pretty smart people. So I have to say, I consider Israel Netanyahu's behavior illogical. There are two components to it. One is that the Netanyahu either has or pretends to have a Holocaust obsession, in which the Iranians are not like even the Soviets, they're like the Nazis. And that if they have an atom bomb, they would, despite the fact that if they attacked Israel, their own country would be destroyed, they would attack anyway because they are insane fanatics. That is what he claims to believe. So from his point of view, of course, again, it gets irrational because, well, Obama's the P5+1 agreement is designed to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon. But nonetheless, they're illogically believing that. Well, the thing is, they want regime change. And in Iran, and they want regime change imposed from the outside. It's sort of like their dream that the same group had about what was his name?
Ahmadinejad?
No, the Iraqi who was their puppet. Remember?
Ahmad Chalabi, right? Yeah.
Yeah, you know that they dream of bringing back someone like the Shah's people, where the Israelis would be in great shape in Iran. Israel does not, and this it's pretty much across the spectrum. Israelis don't think that don't like the idea and will do anything to stop Iran from assuming it's kind of a rightful place as being a significant player in the region. Mm-hmm. Israel likes to be able to do what it wants whenever it wants to. From Netanyahu's point of view, an Iran that's at peace with the United States, because after all, if an agreement is reached, it's not going to just, end this nuclear thing, this nuclear project. There's also going to be good relations between the United States and Iran, because that's what the Iranians want. As you said, the Iranians want to come out from the dark. So that means that all of a sudden, America has other friends in the region, because after all, it's in our interest to be friendly with Iran right now, because because we have the same, the same enemies. You know, but Al-Qaeda, the Al-Qaeda and the Sunni fanatics in Iraq.
And Syria, right.
Israel worries about that whole, Israel will do anything to deny Iran any piece of regional hegemony. Mm-hmm. They want regional hegemony, and they basically have it now. I mean, they can accept, sharing it with the Saudis, but not the Iranians.
Well, Amjad, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Again, I've been speaking with MJ Rosenberg as a special correspondent at the Washington Spectator and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years and previously served as a director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how in West Virginia toxins have been present throughout the state, and this latest focus on chemical spill is business as usual in amongst the coal and the mountaintop removal companies in West Virginia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bob Kincaid, who's the co-founder of the Appalachians Communities Health Emergency Campaign and president of Coal River Mountain Watch, and also the founder of the Head On Radio Network, on which he's a regular host. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bob Kincaid.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And obviously your state of West Virginia is very much in the news because of the chemical spill that's affected the 300,000 residents in the Kenai Valley who, for what, 5 days on, they're still out of water, without drinking water and water to bathe in. And the water that I've seen in pictures in bathtubs looks absolutely foul. And I can't believe that anybody thinks that that water is ready to drink. So just give us a brief update, because obviously what I want to talk to you about is that the broader environmental and health issues affecting the people of West Virginia beyond this current crisis, because apparently West Virginia residents are exposed to deadly toxins routinely, which are used across the state in mining and mountaintop coal removal. So let's just touch on the current story and then move on to what we want to talk about.
Absolutely. I think we need to understand the present status of this disaster as having entered phase two. They have said, they've told people to flush their lines. They're slowly trying to return water service to the entire area, and they are doing so on what has been described as very, very shaky science. The absolute latest breaking news on this is that the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, have issued a warning that pregnant women in the nine-county affected area should not drink the tap water at all until such time as it is certified to contain absolutely no methyl chlorohexane methanol.
So what's the official state? What's the official statement from the government? Are they saying it's safe to drink the water?
Yes.
They are. Yes.
They established somewhat arbitrarily this standard of one part per million, which derives from the only study that's ever been done on this chemical, which was done by the chemicals manufacturer, that established the lethal dose mortality rate on a group of lab rats.
So I understand, for example, that the Elk River runs under the Ohio River, and now the city of Cincinnati is closing off its ducts that used for taking drinking water out of the river until this water passes through. So, you know, and you see pictures of people filling their bathtubs with this brown, brackish water. Are people heeding the government? Why the hell is the government telling people to drink water when it's clearly not clean?
I'm somewhat of a cynic on this, I suppose one might say. I believe that this determination is driven. This is not a scientific determination, Ian. This is a determination that has been based on political needs and corporate profit needs. West Virginia American Water needs to get the water flowing again, because this is a publicly traded corporation whose shareholders will not sit still for losing money.
And in the case of Freedom Industries, my understanding is that that they're likely to get nailed because they're a small fry. But Massey Cole, the same U.S. attorney who's supposed to be looking into Freedom Industries, is also the same U.S. attorney who gave a free pass to Massey Cole over the Big Branch mine.
That's not entirely so.
Well, no, a couple of the executives got nailed, but the top people seem to get away.
He says he's still building a case toward the upper echelons, and of course the upper echelons means Don Blankenship.
Right.
Massey has since been acquired by Alpha Natural Resources, and what we need to understand is that there is a bright line that runs from Freedom Industries, Orwellianly named as it is, from Freedom Industries to the coal industry itself, because this is a chemical that would not have been in Charleston, West Virginia, were it not used in the coal processing and preparation cycle.
So tell me about this washing coal. This chemical is used to wash coal. So what does that mean? That when you dig the coal up, like with mountaintop removal, you got bits of earth and bits of twigs and whatever in it. Is that what happens here, that this chemical leaches out the other, you know, rock and dirt and other stuff? Is that what happens?
Yeah, apparently the way this chemical works is it causes impurities like clay and other kinds of rock to separate itself from the coal, so that the coal is then free of these so-called impurities.
But so boy, that means this chemical
for use in coal-fired power plants and the like.
Right, but that must mean that this chemical is pretty potent. If you can extract rock from coal, it's pretty toxic, isn't it? I mean, it seems
that's the thing, Ian. Nobody knows.
I see.
Nobody knows.
Okay.
By virtue of the fact that the Toxic Substances Control Act is largely toothless and gutted as a result of conservative politics. And the fact that a plan that would have prevented this disaster altogether was rejected 3 years ago by the governor of this state, Earl Ray Tomlin, and the fact that this is a proprietary for-profit chemical that is closely guarded as a business secret by its manufacturer, nobody knows what it does.
Well, again,
the only thing we know is that at a rate of 845 parts per million, I think I'm getting this right, it kills half of the lab rats within 24 hours who are subjected to it.
Again, I'm speaking with Bob Kincaid, who's the co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign, president of the Coal River Mountain Watch, and founder of the Head On Radio Network, of which he's a regular host in West Virginia. So tell me, let's go to the subject, which is why I called you, Bob, which is the broader environmental and health issues affecting the people of West Virginia, because just our focus is on the 300,000 residents of the Kenai Valley, but the entire state has been subject and exposed to deadly toxins routinely used in mining and mountaintop removal. So give me an overall picture of the state.
In essence, for about a decade and a half or a little bit more, this state and central Appalachia generally, which is encompassed by eastern Kentucky, southwest Virginia, and northeast Tennessee, has experienced something called mountaintop removal coal mining. It is a process by which an entire mountain is leveled, and what's on top of the coal is scraped away, dumped in valleys, streams are buried, and then they get at the coal. Now, sometimes these are six-inch seams of coal, but it's very profitable because it does not use a lot of human labor. It's largely mechanized. In this process, 5.5 million pounds of the same high explosives that Timothy McVeigh used on the Murrah Federal Building back in 1995 are used in our communities across central Appalachia. 5.5 million pounds per day. In that process, 500 mountains have been destroyed, the oldest mountains on Earth. 2,000 miles of streams or more have been buried. Water has been fouled. The air has been polluted. And what we've found out in the last few years, by virtue of some scientific inquiry, is that people who innocently live near these operations are experiencing cancer in shockingly elevated rates as compared to the general population or Appalachia as a whole. People are suffering elevated cancer rates. People are experiencing elevated birth defect rates. It goes on and on and on. And the purpose of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign was to bring attention to these studies that show that people are being killed for profit and sickened for profit in the mountaintop removal sacrifice zone of central Appalachia. That resulted in the introduction in June of 2012 and the reintroduction in January of 2013 of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, the AIC Act. It's H.R. 526 in the House of Representatives, and it calls for a cessation of the issuance of new permits for mountaintop removal until a fully funded federal study can be accomplished to determine what the causal links are between mountaintop removal and these clusters of horrifying disease.
So it would seem that the outrage of the ecological destruction of this state and of these mountains, you say they're the oldest in the world, is not sufficient, at least so far. It hasn't stopped it, right? But the fact that all the people in the neighborhood are dying at an unusually high rate, that may finally get somebody's attention? Is that what you're telling me?
We hope so. We are working diligently, even as we speak, to get more support for the bill in the House of Representatives. We are begging, we are pleading for some senator to introduce a companion bill to it in the Senate of the United States, because this is not an aesthetic or esoteric argument anymore about whether or not nature is pretty. People who live here are being sickened, poisoned, and killed. This has become an existential crisis, Ian.
So what about Jay Rockefeller? He's your senator, and he's on the way out, right? Why doesn't he do it?
I wish I had the answer to that. We've asked ourselves, and we don't get an answer.
Right.
He has nothing to fear from the coal industry anymore. The rest of the political class of West Virginia is held completely and entirely in thrall by the coal industry. Joe Manchin, the senator, is not the senator from West Virginia. He's the senator from the coal industry. The same applies to Representative Shelley Moore Capito, Representative David McKinley, Representative Nick Joe Rahal, the governor of the state, Earl Ray Tomlin. They are all captive subsidiaries of the coal industry. Jay Rockefeller has manifested over the course of his distinguished career genuine concern for the well-being of America's citizenry. Why he remains silent in the face of this shocking, horrifying data about the health and well-being of his own constituents in the mountaintop removal sacrifice zone is simply beyond me, Ian.
So just in closing, what is the local West Virginia word for Democrats and Republicans?
Oh, we don't have those, Ian. We have Colocrats and Colicans.
God. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Bob Kincaid. Let's do a follow-up, too, because we barely scratched the surface here. I appreciate it.
I would love to talk to you at greater length about this, Ian.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Bob Kincaid, who's the co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign and president of the Coal River Mountain Watch and founder of the Head on Radio Network, of which he's a regular host in West Virginia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down in America.